Let's hear some of that movie chat. Credits roll by and I tip my hat. Credits roll by, wanna know more right away. Let's have some of that movie chat. Credits roll by, tell me who did that. Life in the credits is where I wanna play.
Welcome to Life in the Credits. This is the show where we learn about entertainment by chatting with people who work in the industry. I'm Susan.
And I'm Ben. And today we're discussing the film Young Frankenstein.
And joining us today is our special guest, Brendan Bradley. So welcome, Brendan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Brendan.
Hi, friends. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for jumping on today. So can you tell us a little bit about what you do in the entertainment world, Brendan?
Sure. I'm an actor and self-proclaimed scrappy storyteller. I've worked on over 100 TV shows, movies, video games, and commercials. And right now what I do in the entertainment industry is I go to Paramount 5 days a week, and I'm one of the head volunteers and strike captains on the front lines there.
Yeah. Oh,
that's fantastic. Before we get too far into it, can you tell us a little bit about any of the projects you have worked on?
Sure. I mean, pack a lunch. It's been varied and all over the place. I think what's fun but also confusing about my career is I have that career that we all imagine an actor is supposed to have and allowed to have. And then you get into the industry and you're supposed to find your niche or your box or your brand. And I'm very bad at branding because I just like doing everything. And so I think the things that I most stand out for are I was Grandpa Russo on Wizards of Waverly Place. Okay. I played their grandpa when they went back in the past. I was the Staples guy for 3 years. Yeah. So I was the national spokesperson for Staples. I've been on a variety of big internet projects like The Guild, Legend of Neil, My Own Squatters, School of Thrones, and a variety of other viral weird things that many different people have seen, including things like Assassin's Creed, the musical, which then leads into like my video game career where like I've been in Resident Evil and Marvel's Midnight Suns. So I think those are the big like standouts that most people recognize. And then there's my own work, which randomly sometimes people recognize my work from projects that I wrote, directed, and scrapped together with my friends.
Awesome. Very cool.
And you do also do a lot of work in the VR space, correct?
True. Basically, in 2017, I got really into virtual reality as a way to put audiences in the world of a scene, basically like a lot tour inside the headset. And so we took a sci-fi show to Comic-Con inside of a VR headset so people could actually walk around in the show. Cool. And then we wanted to produce a whole movie that way. So we did a version of Macbeth using virtual reality. And during the COVID shutdown, I was like, what if we could do all this with a live theater? And I've now spent the last 5 years basically traveling the world doing live virtual reality on stage and virtually across 3 continents, including today, right after this interview, I will perform live in Toronto in virtual reality.
So cool. That's and wild. So innovative, like just a really, really interesting area of acting that I've never really thought much about how it works and everything. So
it's just like the Fringe Festival. Yeah, you're taking over a non-traditional space. Yeah. It's a video game that you're like, hey, what if we did theater in here?
That's so cool.
So very quickly, just the basics. How does that work? Like, what's the logistics of, are you filming yourself and then they're just screening it over there? How does that really come together?
So basically how this works is that virtual reality, for the most part, and specifically what I use, which is web VR, imagine basically a 3D extension to the 2D internet. So you go to a website that happens to be a 3D environment that if you were at your computer, you could walk around on your arrow keys and your mouse. But if you type that same URL into a virtual reality headset, you can actually be embodied inside the world. When you turn your head, you're looking around like you're in the space. You use your controllers, like your hands, to be able to click and interact with things. I can hand you objects. You can hand them back to me. You can throw stuff at me. And it's basically, imagine being inside of a multi-user environment with a live actor for open world gameplay, improvising with you, hopefully guiding you down the correct narrative path, but then being ready to respond to whatever that audience wants to do in real time.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
The show as it exists, and I've done about 6 of these that I've traveled around the world. I'm an actor wearing VR.
Right.
And either co-present with me at the same space in the same venue or at home in the comfort of their own home, other audience members in VR join me on stage in the virtual space.
Okay.
The added layer to that is when I perform on stage, the audience members are on stage with me. They are on. It's like a magic show where you bring people up and they're wearing headsets on stage with me, co-creating the story.
Oh, cool.
And then we just have the seated audience sitting there watching what we're all manifesting together. So they can see the audience avatar. So when a lady and this happens a lot, when a lady just runs off into the distance, I go okay, bye. And we can see that I have to go chase after her.
Wow, that's cool.
So you actually did establish the Integrative Technology Lab for Tisch, too, correct?
Correct, at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts.
Yeah. Is that really where your interest in the VR space started, or did it start well before that?
Well before that. I think that lab specifically, I approached the university in 2016 about non-traditional tools for live storytelling. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's when I first started getting into video game acting, and I was whoa. This is theater. That's all this is. This is live theater inside of a digital system. And I'm making much more money than I was at regional theater. So I was we should be training every single BFA actor to do this. Because it's a job, it pays well. And it is all of the craft of mask work and physicalization and embodied performance. And so to basically gesture towards the curriculum I thought my alma mater should have, I first created a fund and a grant, which led into a lab or an incubator, which led into an actual course, which is called the Integrative Technology Lab, that usually one semester a year allows cross-disciplinary. So we have game design students, we have dancers, we have actors, we have directors, filmmakers, and it's three different survey instructors that come in from the real world with a real world technology. It's not always VR, it's something different every time. And the students basically interact with three real prototypes and have to figure out how they would apply their creative practice to this new technology.
That's fascinating. So why don't we back up a little bit and tell us a little bit about your career and how you got started and into the industry?
Sure. I started, I think it doesn't surprise you based off of what we've already discussed, I started in live theater, specifically in community-based theater in North Carolina. I was an hour away from any actual place to perform as a kid. and so thankfully, my parents did a lot of driving. And it allowed me to really access how exciting it was to be in front of an audience. And my first play was actually in The Round. So the first time I was on a proscenium stage, it was confusing that I couldn't turn around and put my back to the audience. I was like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
which I think lended itself towards my fascination with not just film, TV, but also new technologies that allow you to truly move to wherever the narrative wants to be.
Yeah.
I got to go to New York University. I started producing theater in high school and then in college with my friends, which then I think was a early taste of what became this creator economy. I was basically making my own work from the beginning. So it was never weird to me when I was like, oh, we have a camera in our pocket. Let's make something.
Very, very cool. So just for the audience members who might not know what In the Round means, that means you're on a circular stage and the audience is all the way around you, correct?
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
Yeah. So is the process for the kind of live theater you're doing now in terms of prepping a role, is it similar to when you're doing live or in-person acting?
I think it's very similar. I think that there's two unique concepts to it. So film is a window, right, with the frame of what we choose we're going to see. Then I think virtual reality performance is a hallway in the sense that I know where we want to go, right? There is a narrative structure. Yeah. But the pacing of how we get there, where we stop along the way, we might have little red herrings spread out on the walls or a little open doorway to peek inside.
Yeah.
That's the variability that allows for playability and play style and repeat performance. Okay. And then part of that rehearsal is how do you navigate letting them have agency, the audience, but also controlling that we will go down a narrative path and have a fulfilling narrative arc. The second component or major philosophy behind it is what is starting to be called in academia tri-presence or triple presence.
Okay.
And it's this concept that I am technically, the way I have to rehearse and perform exist in three different dimensions simultaneously. Okay. There is my, no matter where I'm performing, like today I'll just be performing in my office in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I'm not in Toronto, but the players will be in Toronto and I am here in Los Angeles. But I am still in a physical room. and there are walls and there are other, you know, there's pets and there's chairs and I can't run into those things. And I have to be able to navigate my embodied performance in the safety and confines of this physicalized space and my physicalized body. Then the second point of presence is the virtual world. There are walls and structures and physics of that virtual world that I have to obey, even if they are not identical to my physical environment, so that I don't contradict that world or break the illusion. I can't walk through a virtual wall just because I have room to walk through it in my physical room.
Right.
Then there's this beautiful third presence that I think is the sweet spot. And I won't be able to technically do it today, but when I do this work, typically I am also on stage in front of a seated audience.
Okay.
And we project the virtual world onto a large format screen like an IMAX. Yeah.
Awesome.
That becomes puppetry because now they can see me, the actor, and they can see the puppet that I am puppeting in virtual space simultaneously, which means then I want to bring in traditional stagecraft and cinematography stagecraft because I want to open for a camera to reveal and demonstrate that work in a compelling way. I want them to see that one-to-one relationship between me and the puppet. And in some ways, if I was trying to really obey the physical environment or really obey the virtual environment, I might kind of stack up on myself or distract from that revelation or that demonstration. So in some ways, it's keeping in mind at all times those three different realities, those three different presences for a compelling performance at every single audience point.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So let's switch genres for just a second.
Yes.
Talk about micro budget projects. So Brenda, can you tell us first off, can you just define what is a micro budget project?
That's a great wow. I think everybody in the world would have a different definition. What I will tell you is if you ask any producer in Hollywood, there is no money. There is no budget. So I think everyone would say they are a micro budget.
Sure. Yeah.
But I would define specifically, I come from the world of what was called shoestring theater or micro budget theater, which then lent itself to adding a camera and creating like web content or web series. I think of a micro budget truly as being a project that truly has $0. There is no committed funding or investment in this project. It is truly being built out of sweat equity and ensuring, I think the best partnerships and the best projects come from ensuring that we don't then think because we spent no money, it has no value. Everybody's contributions at that point remain as valuable as if we were compensating them. We're just dealing with a different monetary structure. And what I like to say is money isn't the thing. Money is the thing that helps you buy the thing. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have money, how do you also get the thing still? And then what is that negotiation or barter or ownership that you need to provide to your collaborators to make sure that if you're not paying for it monetarily, you're paying for it in some other way?
How involved are you in those kind of projects? And is that something where you wear a lot of hats or do you have a specialty?
I think that anybody who works in micro budget filmmaking or project management of any kinds has to wear a billion hats. You are you are the person doing all the things because you can't hire someone to do the crappy parts.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've been basically involved in those sorts of projects ever since I was in high school, fell in love with theater, did not have access to a theater. There was no theater at my high school. And so my mom said, well, I guess you're going to put on a play. And I was like, well, how do you do that? She's like, I don't know. You're going to figure that out, I guess. And the idea of if you want to have an outlet for your creativity, sometimes you're the one who has to manifest it. Mm-hmm. And so from the very beginning, I was literally in parking lots, crowdfunding money, trying to get donations to be able to rent rehearsal space in a venue. Yeah. I built the set in my garage with my siblings. I licensed a play from Samuel French and negotiated what that deal looked like. And that scaffolded into when I started making early web series, where I started kind of, I rented out a single cubicle of a WeWork or a WeWork competitor called Blank Spaces that became the office set for the entire show. And as long as we didn't shoot anybody else in the background that was renting the space, we were technically allowed to do whatever we wanted in our cubicle. And then that led to me bartering my first movie. I cold called tourism boards to be able to film the movie across three continents because it was a travel rom-com.
Wow.
And so we got free airfare, free hotels, free meals, free equipment on the ground, all through strategic partnerships and collaborating with branded partners across three different continents.
Wow.
That's incredible.
what are some of those projects that you've worked on recently? Is it anything that like listeners would be able to watch?
Absolutely. Okay. You can watch my first feature film, Non-Transferable. If you like Lifetime fluffy rom-coms, it is available pretty much all the places on free-to-viewer streaming platforms like Tubi and stuff like that, or Freevee, and Amazon Prime and all those things. I did a adaptation of Macbeth using virtual reality and mixed reality with my friends. We made a feature film for $30,000 and a lot of sweat equity. I taught myself 3D animation to be able to make the movie. it was an absolute nightmare. The Scottish curse is real. It is very real. But you can watch that on Vimeo right now. It's called A Tale Told by an Idiot. And then my virtual reality musical, I'm touring around the world right now at your computer or in your web browser or in your headset.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the strike right now. So obviously you're very involved in this, Brendan, but can you get started by telling us why are actors striking?
At the bare minimum, this is just a boring labor issue. This is wages and working conditions like any other labor issue and any other industry. We are a part of what is called hot labor summer, where I think we've just reached a point that so many contract negotiations, especially through COVID, I don't think people are aware that these are standard negotiations for contracts that expire every 3 years. Mm-hmm. This was not some surprise or some new thing. Every 3 years, we're supposed to sit down, renegotiate these contracts, make changes based off of the state of the world. And we have not struck this contract in over 40 years. Mm-hmm. We've not taken a major labor action as a union in 40 years because we've tried to avoid this. We've tried to be very reasonable and be very understanding. In 2020, we knew this contract was not being reflective of the state of the world, inflation, cost of living. There's a major thing that people don't know about that, like, our healthcare changed during the global pandemic, and about a quarter of the members that were on that health plan got kicked off of it because of the new qualifications and new policies. And we didn't strike because we went, now is not the time. People are out of work. This is not the right move. But then we expected people in good faith, our employers in good faith, to make those improvements, and they didn't. And so the best statistic is, when you think about the whole state of the entertainment industry, the best statistic that I have found that really speaks to the major issue is we have to earn $26,000 a year to qualify for our healthcare benefit that we then pay into it and pay the premiums like anybody else. But for us to have access to healthcare, we have to make $26,000 a year. 87% of SAG-AFTRA members do not meet this qualification.
That's wild.
So 87% of SAG-AFTRA members, the people striking out there, the actors you see on television and film, they don't make above the poverty line.
Yeah.
So when we're striking, it isn't that we're trying to get our second yacht here.
Right.
we're just trying to be able to afford to live in very crappy apartments.
Yeah. I think that's good to hear because, I mean, I think with social media, the awareness is better. And I know we've talked to some writers who have said social media has made it much easier this time than it was in 2008 to get the message out there. But it's still good to repeat it and hear, like, you're striking for very basic things that an employer should want to help you get so that you can keep working. So I think it's good for people to hear. And your role specifically is you're the strike captain at Paramount, correct?
That is correct. There are a variety of us called strike captains. So basically I was out there day one with the Writers Guild, being a sympathetic striker, showing my support about 3 days a week. And I got to know some of the WGA strike captains because they have an existing system in place, both for a strike fund, but also while they're working, like in regular times, they have a captain system so that you have an ally to go, hey, I have a paycheck issue, or hey, there's some harassment happening behind the scenes that I want to talk to somebody about. So you've got an advocate or a big brother, big sister in the room with you. SAG does not have that at all. We've never had that system. So when we looked at down the barrel and saw we were probably going to also join them on strike, our leadership went to the WGA and said, hey, who are the actors you know that have been out there with you and might know how this all works? Yeah. And so based off of that, we got nominated by the WGA strike captains to then be assigned to a lot. Okay. So technically, I'm closer to Warner Brothers, and I would have loved to have kept driving there every morning. But I got assigned to Paramount.
Okay.
And basically, we were boots on the ground first day at Paramount. We learned very quickly from our WGA siblings. And then we've been enacting boring stuff like the scheduling, safety protocols, traffic protocols when people try to drive through the pedestrians, being able to make sure there's water and snacks at all the different gates that we're trying to service, sunscreen. And then we have support from our staff members that are on the ground with us running what we would consider the base camp on site.
Yeah. So it's a very like logistical job of just keeping people safe, essentially, so that
you can
continue to keep the strike and the lines going and people there.
We're really glorified traffic guards, and we're kind of running we're running a mini Coachella at 8 different locations across Los Angeles.
That's very cool. So if people, you know, want to support SAG, what's a good way they can do that?
I think the first thing is to come out and join us on the line. You do not need to be a member to join us on the strike lines. And I think what's important about that is so rarely in entertainment is there this sense of community. I mean, you all have an incredible podcast and community built off of the idea that people want access to the knowledge and the resources of what is it like to work in this field. Mm-hmm. And being able to literally walk out on the corner of Melrose and meet showrunners and directors and filmmakers and professional actors, it's like going to grad school. There's a free grad school happening on the sidewalk every day. You just need to show up, which is incredible.
Yeah.
If you cannot be present, I think the biggest thing is making sure that you're sharing information coming from the guilds themselves. There's a lot of disinformation, unfortunately, that gets leaked to the press and the trades for the sensationalism of a story or a good talking point. Mm-hmm. So I think always make sure you know the source of the knowledge that you yourself are echoing and sharing. But then the Entertainment Community Fund, a lot of people don't know this, was set up to help subsidize and fund, even in times of non-striking, anybody who works in the entertainment community. That includes our IATSE siblings, our crew members that may be suffering or may need to stopgap their healthcare benefits at even during normal times. Mm-hmm. That fund is there to really support anybody who works in the entertainment space to help make ends meet. And so donating to the Entertainment Creators Fund is an incredible way to help everybody that may be impacted by this strike, not just the writers and actors.
Nice.
Great.
You can pull from whatever part of your career you want for to answer this, because it's kind of a vague question, but what's been like a big challenge in your career that maybe you weren't expecting, or that just came up a lot, or one you were expecting and you just found out how to deal with?
Sure. I mean, I think that as a elder millennial, we are constantly being introduced to new mediums and modes of our career, not just in the entertainment space. I think when we look back to the early aughts, how many people, no matter what industry or business they're in, were like, I need a website? Why do I need a website? And now everybody's got like four websites, right? It became this normalized process of adding this layer and this know-how of media literacy and technology literacy that I think has really been a defining component of our generation. And so every time these get introduced, that's a challenge. That's hard work. I want to acknowledge like how many people I know at their normal 9-to-5 job who are being asked to like run the social media account or like take on, could you edit a podcast for us? Like that is like a normal thing we ask normal people now all the time. And so I think that the generosity of understanding these tools are meant to empower especially your own creative process, they do not have to be for you. You do not have to be literate or knowledgeable in all of them. You can take them or leave them as you'd like. I think they are incredibly powerful tools and very cool creative tools. But I think that in some ways we get a little callous to this idea of adapt or die. Like we're hearing a lot of this around AI right now, of this knowledge that you're just supposed to be good at everything. And I think that there's beauty in being really passionate about what you're passionate about, doing the work that's meaningful to you, and then letting someone else do something if they want to do it. going back to the micro budget storytelling, I think the greatest lesson that I have found is when I direct on camera, I don't have a monitor. I don't ever look in monitor. I can't afford one. I don't have a video village because what I do is I know I can't afford to pay the cinematographer or the director of photography what they are worth. And so I'm going, hey, this is your creative practice. This is your artistry. I trust you. We're going to have conversations around what we want the look and feel of the show to be. I'm going to focus on the performance and the rest of the movie parts and mechanics. But this is your department. I'm giving you this hat. I'm giving you this responsibility and ownership. And I trust you to make work that is compelling to you. And I think that in a lot of ways, diversifying and delegating is an incredible way to circumvent some of the challenges of taking on any large scale project.
Yeah,
for sure. That makes total sense.
Well, we didn't talk about your Staples spokesperson job yet. I didn't know if you wanted to go into more detail about what that was like.
Sure. I like to say that I won the lottery. It's one of those jobs that I don't know that will even exist in the future. It's one of those crazy things to do. Ironically speaking, it meant that I got to meet like Stephanie, who is Flo, and Milana, who is Lily, because we actually then were in this small little club, like sharing advice and contract negotiation, which was great. But what it basically meant was I went to an audition. I auditioned for this job. They knew it was going to be a spokesperson job. They knew it was a 3-year contract.
Okay.
I auditioned. I was shooting a pilot in Arizona when I got the callback. And I drove. We wrapped at like midnight and I got in the car and I drove back to Los Angeles 6 hours I could be there in the morning to go to my callback. The callback was the craziest thing I've ever done. I had to do, like in the room, I had to do 6 different commercials that they were changing the copy on every few minutes. I had to do 2 radio commercials and show them I could do like microphone technique and podcast technique and speak really fast, like all that disclaimer of like, at the end. I had to do a photo shoot so that they could see like what I would look like on billboards and stuff like that. I had to tap dance. I had to sing. I had to improvise. I had to pretend to do a one-on-one like meetup and like client event as if I was like glad handing CEOs and stuff like that. Like they basically took me through all the possible expectations of what this job was going to be. I left and there was like a group of, I think, 6 other guys sitting out in the lobby. I walked out exhausted, just spent. And I remember looking at the rest of the room and I went, look, whoever gets this deserves it.
Yeah.
I was like, that's the hardest thing I've ever done. And I'm just very grateful that it went my way. I got to do that contract for 3 years. And it was one of these incredible things that basically they owned me for 3 years, that I had to take everything second position. So when I booked a film, I had to tell them that at any time I would have to leave set literally to go fly and do commercials. I couldn't go to one of my best friend's weddings because at the last minute they wanted to shoot some stuff.
Wow.
It completely took ownership over my life, but it was a pair of golden handcuffs. I wasn't making $1 million or even $1 million, but I had a very, very good life for a little theater boy that was getting to sell office supplies for a living and then, you know, be creative on the side.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's wild. Well, Brendan, do you have a favorite moment or an unbelievable moment from your career that really stands out as a moment where you're like, I can't believe this is what I'm doing right now?
I think everything is unbelievable. Yeah. None of it makes any sense to me. It is when I really think about, I think that sometimes the further, you know, the goalpost always moves, right? The more we accomplish or the more we do, the more we set our sight on the horizon. And if I could go to 16-year-old Brendan producing his first play in North Carolina because there literally wasn't a theater and tell him that you're going to be in New York and Los Angeles and London performing with some of the like most incredible stars in the world, and they are going to have a similar passion and work ethic and love of the business and performing, and we're all going to hustle together, and you're still never going to make a lot of money or be able to afford a house. but also, hey, this whole problem that you can't find a theater right now, don't worry, in a few years, you won't even need a physical building. Like, it's all so extraordinary to me. And what I think it really speaks to is that when I encounter challenges today or frustrations today, like the strike or like my own creative process, I know that these are problems that are going to get solved.
Yeah.
Everyone has dealt with these problems in the past. And in a few years, I'm going to take for granted that those were never really problems or hurdles to begin with. Yeah. Like the goalpost will shift again. And so I think that it's all incredible. I can't believe I'm speaking to 2 strangers about working in film and television. Yeah. Like, that's nuts to me.
Well, we're glad you are.
Yes. Yeah. So you've already given some advice, but do you have any other final advice for people who do want to get into theater or acting in any of the spaces that you've worked in?
Absolutely. I think there's 2 funnels or rabbit holes you can go down. If you just want to work creatively, know that I think that we sometimes get swept up into like what counts or what is professional. Professional just means you did the job with integrity, right? Yeah. People get paid in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that remember that the clue to what counts is in the name. If you want to act, acting is doing it. If you want to dance, dancing is doing it. You are doing it. You are fundamentally participating in that creative practice. And that happens, first of all, locally in your own backyard. Get involved with your local communities. There's a film commission. There's a film festival in every single state in the country. Please get involved locally, because you'll probably have a lot more opportunity working in your own backyard and in your own sandbox and bringing your own existing resources and support system rather than moving to someplace where you don't have any of those assets. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to making your own work, I would say it is always easier to talk about money when there is no money. So right at the beginning of any collaboration, get some sort of document, and the internet is an invaluable tool. Mm-hmm. ChatGPT could write it for you.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of ways that you can get some sort of language between the two of you or the three of you or the 20 of you that sets expectations for what happens if and when there is a success or there is money. And that way you can really just get that out of the way and focus on making the darn thing. Because I think a lot of times what really derails projects is once they start to get a little bit of success, all of a sudden infighting and problems and frustrations and misunderstandings mean that you can't level up to that next milestone.
Yeah.
Because you get stuck in this place that could have been resolved if everybody had just done something more than a handshake 3 months prior.
Let's get to our feature film. Today we're discussing the 1974 comedy Young Frankenstein. It was written by Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks and was based on the story by Mary Shelley. It was directed by Mel Brooks and it stars Gene Wilder, Peter Boyle, Marty Feldman, and Terry Garr. So, Susan, can you give us a quick breakdown? What's this movie about?
Yes. So at the beginning of this movie, we meet Dr. Frederick Frankenstein, who is the grandson of Dr. Victor Frankenstein. He's not thrilled about that, so he changes the pronunciation of his name so that he's not tries not to be associated with him. But of course, everyone knows he's his grandson, and they bring it up all the time. He is teaching a class, and he finds out he is in his grandfather's will. So he travels back to Transylvania to his grandfather's castle. He leaves behind his fiancée Elizabeth and meets Inga, who is his new beautiful German assistant, and also Igor. Who is his sort of hunchbacked assistant whose hump changes sides throughout the movie. And he is immediately enraptured by his grandfather's research and starts trying to bring a guy back to life, creating his own Frankenstein's monster. Spoiler, he is successful at, and we see the ramifications of that throughout the movie.
Perfect.
Including a very interesting version of Putting on the Ritz.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's get into it. So why did you choose this movie for us to watch, Brendan? Why did you choose Young Frankenstein?
I chose this movie for a couple reasons. First, it stands the test of time. It's absurd and ridiculous. It's a delightful comedy. If you have not watched it, you have to enjoy it. But I think it also represents a lot of the components of my career that we're talking about today.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, we're talking about, you know, Gene Wilder wrote it. He wrote this movie for him to be in. And Mel Brooks made it because Mel Brooks needed him to be in Blazing Saddles. And they basically did a tradesies. They basically were like, hey, all right, let's work on each other's project. And that seeing that that can come at such a high level, it's still collaboration. It's still helping each other out. It's still non-monetary compensation. Mm-hmm. You can also tell how much fun they're having on set. At all times. Like, you can almost see them breaking in half of the shots, which is incredible. And you're getting to work with people that I think are at the like highest level of not just their game and their time, but of the legacy of comedy. I mean, Marty Feldman, Madeline Kahn, we are looking at people who it never got better than that. Like, they are true comedic masters. It is a masterclass always watching their work. The final thing I would say is that we are in a culture right now and a trend right now of remix culture. A lot of social media content, a lot of even big blockbuster movies. It's about derivative and recontextualizing. Look at the success Barbie is having right now.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think you could at its face say, everyone's done Frankenstein. This is boring. Who needs another Frankenstein? And yet I would actually say that Young Frankenstein is for me the quintessential official Frankenstein of the canon. I'm sorry, Mary. I'm sorry. But like, this to me is the one that will always be my go-to. And so I think it just kind of hits a constellation of everything we talked about today within a really great film if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. And yeah, Gene Hackman's also in this movie.
Oh my God. No cigars. Like a really small part.
It's
crazy.
It's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, there's so many people in it. The whole cast, like you said, you can tell they're having fun and they do such a good job of just letting that come through. And every performance, even the small ones, are really, really funny. The little girl, she's really like just great performance. In the well.
That gets thrown down the well.
This is a classic Mel Brooks, right? So it's gonna have it's gonna have a ton of jokes in it. Some of them are a little problematic these days. I'm a little more than a little, but
absolutely.
This is actually a movie that my sister and I grew up watching. We watched it a lot. This is like on the regular rotation on the TV growing up. Still funny. And we rewatched it just before we recorded this. I'm like, man, I just love this scene. Oh, I love this scene. It's just like throughout the whole movie, it's like, oh, so well made and so fun. And Gene Wilder is phenomenal.
Absolutely.
He's so great.
Yeah. And there's so many different kinds of jokes. There's like really, really stupid jokes. Yeah. There's one, there's like sight gags. It's just, it's kind of everything.
There's literal sight gags.
I'm trying to think, what was the joke where I watched it? I was like, that is so dumb. But I was like laughing so hard.
The werewolf joke.
The werewolf joke. Like that is like. But it's also like exactly what you want out of the Mel Brooks movie.
So Brendan, do you have a favorite scene from the film?
Again, it's, there's this constellation of different types of humor and different types of styles in it. I will always love him saying, whatever happens, do not let me out of this room.
And then
immediately turning around and wanting to be let out of the room. You know, rolling in the hay is fantastic. Walk this way. Obviously, the fact that the hump on the shoulder is moving sides every single scene. You know, there's just so much to kind of track throughout it. And I think another thing to kind of speak to is we talk about like, of course, Mel Brooks, like can do no wrong. Have you seen the box set of Mel Brooks?
No.
So there's a box set of Mel Brooks work that is, of course, the classics, the features that we all know. And then in between each one are shorts.
Oh, really?
And they are not all successful. And I think that it's really liberating. But what you can see is you can see an artist finding, you can see the things that go into Young Frankenstein, that go into Spaceballs, that get recycled and refined into what becomes his next big hit. But he's workshopping, he's tinkering, he's finding it. And I think in some ways, we don't always remember, it goes back to like moving the goalpost. We don't always remember that artists are always iterating and exploring and experimenting and failing. And there's something really lovely about getting to see the great Mel Brooks do something that falls a little flat or isn't quite fully realized yet. So that then you can see it stair step into what becomes the next stroke of brilliance.
And you really do, especially with comedies. So, I mean, you see with stand-ups all the time, they have to get up there and they have to go to small venues to practice, to hone their jokes, to see what really plays. And it's cool that they actually made that available. We'll have to check that out.
Yeah, that's really, I love that.
Speaking of that, I saw Eddie Izzard one time on stage and they did 45 minutes about a giraffe that was not funny, was just fundamentally not funny. And then I saw the taping of the final like run of that special and there's two lines about a giraffe that kill, that kill. But I was like, oh, I sat there through the workshop night. Right. Okay, cool.
Cool. You saw the behind the scenes building it.
Development. That's phenomenal. Susan, did you have a favorite scene?
Well, there's a lot of great scenes. I feel like the putting on the Ritz scene is so classic. I just really love that one.
That one does make me laugh. I love it. And then, as I mentioned, the scene with the blind man was my favorite scene.
Yeah, that was
the expression when Gene Hackman is trying to just give him a cheers with his mug and breaks the mug.
Just breaks the mug.
The camera.
And the creature's like reaction to that is so funny to me of just pure frustration. It's such a dumb, I love that joke though.
Yeah, and it's a good twist because like Frankenstein is supposed to be terrorizing the town, right? But he's just trying to get through his day and the town is terrorizing him.
Well, and getting to watch the brilliance of the physical comedy of someone like Peter Boyle in that role that you know, that could be so easily overplayed or campy, but knowing what level of camp it lives with inside of and then actually being a sympathetic character through that whole experience.
For sure.
And again, pay attention to those opening and closing credits to really understand like Gene Wilder wrote the darn thing. Like that's they created this vehicle for themselves and you can too.
We'd like to finish up our show today with a game that we're calling Movie Monster Mash. In honor of Young Frankenstein, we're going to see how both of you know movies featuring classic film monsters. So Brendan and Susan, you'll be playing as a team. So here are the rules. I've given you each a list of movies that feature movie monsters. You will take turns describing the film's characters, plot, and quotes to each other as quickly as you can, but you cannot use the name of the movie. You will have 1 minute to get your partner to guess as many as possible. And if you get 5 correct, then Brendan will win our prize. And Susan, what's our prize?
Some Life in the Credits merchandise, like a shirt or a hat or a tote bag. Yeah, lots of different options.
Yeah, merch. All right. So, Brendan, are you ready to play?
I think so.
Susan, are you ready?
Ready.
All right. I'm going to start your time as soon as, Brendan, you give the first clue.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Brendan Fraser.
The Mummy?
Correct.
Yes.
This is a guy who sort of stalks a musical theater production. He wears mask, half of a mask.
Oh, Freddy.
Oh, no.
Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
Yes.
We were just talking about this character.
Oh, we were just talking about Frankenstein.
For today's, yes.
Yeah,
okay. This is a guy who hunts vampires. He's famous for hunting vampires.
Oh no. Pass. I'm not gonna.
That's okay. Oh, this is Jeff Goldblum, right? And he turns into a bug.
Oh, the flea?
Close.
The.
It's a bug with wings.
Bug with wings.
You hit it with a swatter.
The fly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We only need one more.
Nicolas Cage just came out.
Oh my gosh. It's Dracula.
Yeah.
Is that all it's called?
No.
But adjacent.
Renfield.
Yes.
Renfield.
Yes. We did it.
That was close.
Who is the person who hunts vampires?
Van Helsing.
Van Helsing.
I also don't know if I would know that off the top of my head if I wasn't staring at it.
No, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
Brendan, you have won the game.
Congratulations.
And before we let you go, Brendan, is there anything that you would like to plug?
Oh, gosh. I'm currently doing Non-Player Character, the musical, which is a virtual reality musical. You can check that out on all the music places like Spotify and Amazon Music, as well as my own website, and maybe come to a show or a rehearsal. I'm Brendan A. Bradley, all of the places. If you find a Brendan A. Bradley on social media, it is very likely me, and I'm happy to answer questions or work with you or talk to you about more of this crazy journey and how you yourself, wherever you are right now in that journey, can get started.
Awesome.
Very cool. Well, thank you for joining us today, Brendan.
Yeah, this was really great.
Pleasure.
Thank you all.
Life in the Credits is hosted and produced by me, Susan Swarner.
And me, Ben Bloom.
It's executive produced by Michelle Levin.
The music is written and performed by Steve Trowbridge. You can hear more of Steve's music at trowbridgesounds.com.
The show logo is created by Melissa Durkin.
If you'd like to support Life in the Credits and get access to exclusive perks, you can do so at patreon.com.
If you'd like to follow or get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Life in the Credits, or shoot us an email at lifeinthecredits@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Look, whoever gets this deserves it.
Yeah.
I was like, that's the hardest thing I've ever done.